Matthew 26, 57 to 27, 26. Then those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered. And Peter was following him at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest. And going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus that they might put him to death. But they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. At last, two came forward and said, "This man said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" And the high priest stood up and said, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But Jesus remained silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said to him, "You have said so, but I tell you, from now on you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his robes and said, "He has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? You have now heard his blasphemy. What is your judgment?" They answered, "He deserves death." Then they spit in his face and struck him, and some slapped him, saying, "Prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is it that struck you?" Now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came up to him and said, "You also were with Jesus the Galilean." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you mean." And when he went out to the entrance, another servant girl saw him, and she said to the bystanders, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." And again he denied it with an oath, "I do not know the man." After a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Certainly you too are one of them, for your accent betrays you." Then he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, "I do not know the man." And immediately the rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the saying of Jesus, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times." And he went out and wept bitterly. When morning came, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And they bound him and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate, the governor. Then when Judas, his betrayer, saw that Jesus was condemned, he changed his mind and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." They said, "What is that to us? See to it yourself." And throwing down the pieces of silver into the temple, he departed, and he went and hanged himself. But the chief priests, taking the pieces of silver, said, "It is not lawful to put them into the treasury, since it is blood money." So they took a council and bought with them the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. Therefore, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken by the prophet Jeremiah, saying, "And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of him on whom a price had been set by some of the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me." Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus said, "You have said so." But when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom they wanted. And they had then a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" For he knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. Besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor again said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release for you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "Then what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" They all said, "Let him be crucified." And he said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Let him be crucified." So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves. And all the people answered, His blood be on us and on our children. Then he released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. You may be seated.
Thanks, Sarah. Well, we are continuing our sermon series in the book of Matthew today. And as we do, like John mentioned last week, we're nearing the end. We've mentioned a few times that our plan as we continue to work our way through the book of Matthew, and as we work toward Matthew's account of Jesus' resurrection on Easter Sunday, just the way that the calendar kind of worked out as we were planning things out, that lined up well. And so that means then in these weeks leading up to Easter, we get the opportunity to walk through Jesus' betrayal, his trial, and his crucifixion. And so in one sense then, just the way that that works out, these weeks leading up to Easter then are kind of like an Easter version of the Advent series that we often do leading up to Christmas, which I love that we do that at Christmas. And honestly, as I've thought about it this week, we probably should do that more often for Easter, like spending these weeks leading up to some of the most important holidays for us as Christians, remembering what it is that we celebrate and why that matters. In doing that, preparing our hearts to feel what we ought to feel as we celebrate what Jesus has done for us, not only in his birth at Christmas, but in his life, his death, and his resurrection that we celebrate at Easter. And so here, two Sundays out from Easter, and we come to a part of the story of Jesus' crucifixion that in one sense is familiar. There's a lot of things in here, as Sarah was reading through this, that are familiar stories, but at the same time, within the context of the bigger Easter story, can kind of get overlooked. And so, like, the thing is, these 45 verses that Sarah just read for us here in chapter 26 and 27, they're not just filler to get from Jesus' betrayal to his crucifixion. Like, Matthew has a point here in our passage this morning that he means for us to see. And so the question is, what is Matthew's point in Jesus' trial? Like, why do these verses matter within the bigger picture of what Matthew's been trying to do since chapter 1? Well, within the flow of Matthew as a whole, from the very beginning of the book, we've been talking about this over and over along the way, Matthew is building a case that Jesus is the promised Messiah King from the line of David, and he's been doing everything that he can along the way to convince us through his account of Jesus' life, of Jesus' teaching, of his miracles, his interactions with his disciples, his conflicts with the Pharisees, and everything else that he's recorded for us that we've gone through together in this book, that Jesus is who he claimed that he is all the way back at the beginning of chapter 1, that Jesus is the Christ, that he's the promised Messiah King from the line of David. But in doing that, Matthew's also showing what that means. He's shown us what it means that Jesus is the Messiah in that sense. It doesn't mean what a lot of people in Jesus' day thought that it meant. They thought that it meant that he was coming to save them from the Romans and reestablish the kingdom of Israel. But Matthew's point is what we saw back in Matthew chapter 1, verse 21, that Jesus was born as the Messiah King from the line of David to save his people from their sins. And so all through this book then, for almost 26 whole chapters now, Matthew's been making his case that this is who Jesus is, and this is what he came to do. And so as we come to Jesus' trial here then in chapter 26 and 27, like it's literally time to render a verdict. Who will people say that Jesus is? Will they receive him as their king, or will they reject him? And so as we go through our passage this morning, that's what we're going to see happening over and over again through these verses. We're going to see different groups of people and different individuals give their verdict on Jesus. And in one sense, the verdict that they all give is shocking, right? Like we know where this is all headed, and Sarah just read it for us. Everyone, like every single person, one by one, rejects Jesus as their king. But here's the thing in that. The way Matthew tells this story highlights the irony of what's going on here. Like, in rejecting Jesus as the promised Messiah King from the line of David, they actually prove him to be exactly who Matthew has been saying he is all along. And in rejecting him, they ultimately cause to happen the very events that lead to his enthronement as king. And so don't miss this. Like, because that's true, that means that one day Jesus is going to be the judge at their trial, at the final judgment. And so it might look like Jesus is the only one who's on trial here in these verses, but actually the way that Matthew tells the story here, the point is that everyone else is on trial as well. And so the question in our passage this morning, over and over again, is who's innocent and who's guilty? Which again, we know where this is headed. And so the question is, as we think about the implications of this, like, how in the world can it possibly be anything other than a tragedy that the one who is shown to be innocent through everything that happens here is ultimately condemned to death by those who show themselves to be guilty? What we're going to see here is that far from being a tragedy, Jesus' trial is actually a powerful and beautiful picture of the gospel. And so you can see there on your handout where we're headed this morning. First, we're going to see the bad news in Matthew's account of Jesus' trial. And so, like, we know this, for good news to really feel like good news, we have to first understand the bad news, right? And so we're going to start there and see how not only is Jesus' trial a verdict on who he is, it's a verdict on who we are. Not just the different people passing their verdict on Jesus back then, but us as well. Us here right now this morning in this room. But then we're going to look at the good news in Jesus' trial. Because as tragic as it seems for an innocent man to be condemned to death, the whole point is that this right here is actually the best news in the world. And Matthew weaves a couple of key details into his account of Jesus' trial that point us then to what is ultimately happening here and how this is all actually really, really good news for us. And so my prayer for us this morning as we go through this text is that we'd see the beauty of the gospel laid out for us in Jesus' trial, and that it would cause us to be humbled at who we are and what we deserve, and then ultimately through that to be in awe of who Jesus is and what he's done for us, so that our hearts would be prepared to rejoice and celebrate Jesus' resurrection and all that it means for us this Easter. And so look with me first then, and you can see this on your handout, look with me first at the bad news in Matthew's account of Jesus' trial. The bad news in Matthew's account of Jesus' trial. So our passage this morning is basically made up of four main sections. The first section, we're going to see Jesus' trial before the Jewish religious leaders. And then in the last section, the end of the passage, we'll see his trial before the Roman authorities. So that's kind of the bookends on the passage. And then in between, we have two accounts about Peter and Judas that take place while Jesus' trial is going on. And so it's important to understand just a little bit of historical context here before we jump into our passage. So if you remember, last week we left off with Jesus being betrayed by Judas and arrested by a group of people led by the chief priests and the elders of the people, meaning the Jewish religious leaders, which might sound kind of strange that their religious leaders are arresting people and then conducting a trial here at the beginning of our passage. That's not usually what we think of religious leaders doing. But the situation at this time is that the Jews are under the authority of Rome. And so they've been allowed some level of authority, especially related to their religious beliefs. And that was overseen then by a council known as the Sanhedrin, which we'll see here in just a minute in the text, that was made up of 70 men plus the high priest. And so the Sanhedrin had a level of authority to keep the peace under the oversight of Rome. But their authority only went so far. So when it comes to Jesus, Matthew's been telling us for a while now that the Jewish religious leaders see Jesus as more and more of a threat, and they want to destroy him. But they can only do so much when it comes to actually carrying out their desires. Like, they can determine that they think that he's a problem and even that he's violating their religious laws, but they don't have the authority to put him to death themselves, which is what they ultimately want to do. And so as we see Jesus' trial here before the Jewish religious leaders, the Sanhedrin, and then how they take him to Pilate, who's the Roman governor in their area, what's going on is that the Sanhedrin is trying to make a case that they can take to the Roman authorities and get them then to actually carry out the death sentence that only Rome has the authority to carry out. So that's what's happening overall in our passage here this morning. Jesus is on trial, and different groups of people that he's that are involved with his trial are determining the charges against him and whether he's innocent or guilty. But as I mentioned a minute ago, as Matthew tells the story, what we're going to see is that as Jesus has passed between the Jewish religious leaders and the Roman authorities, he's not the only one on trial. He's not the only one we're supposed to be asking if he's innocent or guilty. Instead, in each part of Jesus' trial, there's a person or a group of people who is kind of the focus of that section and who we need to ask whether they're innocent or guilty as well. And this is where the bad news in Jesus' trial comes in. And it might be surprising in one sense to hear what the bad news is. Like, in one sense, you might be expecting the bad news to be that Jesus, who's supposed to be the promised Messiah king, is about to be determined to be guilty and deserving to die. Like, that seems like that should be the bad news. But what we're going to see is that's actually not the bad news that we see in our passage here. Instead, you can see this on your handout. The bad news is this. It's that apart from Jesus, everyone is guilty and deserving God's just wrath. That's the bad news that we're going to see as we walk through our passage this morning. So let's go through the passage here and see how this plays out. That the bad news is that apart from Jesus, everyone is guilty and deserving of God's just wrath. First, we're going to see that here in the first section, verses 57 to 68, that the Jewish religious leaders are guilty. This is the first group of people that we're going to look at together here, starting in verse 57. And so we've got a lot of ground to cover this morning. You can tell from the length of the passage that we read. And so we're not going to reread this section again for time's sake. But basically what happens here in verses 57 to 68 is that Jesus stands trial before Caiaphas, the high priest. See that there in verse 57. And then he is also standing trial in front of the whole council, it says in verse 59 here, which that word for the whole council there in verse 59 is the word Sanhedrin that I mentioned a minute ago. So the Sanhedrin, this whole council, is the 70 men plus the high priest, who are kind of like the Jewish Supreme Court, basically, at that time. And so we're told right from the beginning there in verse 59 that their goal is to put Jesus to death. That's their desire, and that's their plan, and that's their goal. But again, like talked about a second ago, they don't have the authority to do that on their own. And the only way that they're going to be able to convince the Roman authorities to put Jesus to death is if they can put together a case against him that proves that he's guilty and that he deserves to die. And so the way that works in their system then is that they need at least two witnesses who have a consistent testimony of something that Jesus had said or done that makes him guilty and that makes him deserving of the death penalty. And so first, in verses 59 and 60 there, they have trouble finding two people whose stories line up. But then if you look at verse 61, finally it says, two witnesses come forward saying, this man said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. And so the thing is, Jesus did say something at least sort of like this that's recorded for us in John chapter 2, verse 19. But it's interesting because when you compare their accusation here with what Jesus actually said in John chapter 2, it seems like even these witnesses are at least exaggerating what Jesus said to make this accusation here. But either way, Jesus doesn't respond to the accusations that are being brought against him. And so the high priest finally puts Jesus under oath. Like, that's what's happening there in verse 63 when he tells Jesus that I adjure you by the living God. Like, he's putting him under oath, like in a courtroom. And so specifically what he's putting Jesus under oath to tell them is whether he's the Christ, it says there in verse 63, whether he's the Christ, the Son of God. And so we've talked about this before in Matthew. In the high priest's mind, those two terms would have been synonymous. So the Christ, we've talked about several times along the way, is the Greek term or the Greek form of the term of the title Messiah. So he's asking if he's the Messiah. And the Son of God, the title that he uses there, and in our minds, we kind of think if he's asking if he is the Son of God, but in their minds, this is a title connected back to 2 Samuel 7, verse 14, and Psalm 2, verse 7, that say that God will call the promised Messiah king from the line of David that is promised in those two passages, that he'll call him his son. So the Son of God then was another term for the Messiah as well. And so the high priest is asking Jesus under oath, using these two different terms, if he is the Messiah, which in one sense seems kind of out of left field based on the accusation that was brought in verse 61. But in the context of 2 Samuel 7, where the Messiah is going to be the one who builds a house for God's name, it's not surprising that the high priest would move from this accusation of rebuilding the temple to this question, are you actually the Messiah? And so, there's so much I wish we had time to get to in Jesus' response here. Jesus only speaks twice in this entire passage, in all these verses that we read. Here in verse 64, and then when he responds to Pilate later in chapter 27, verse 11. And his response in both places is almost identical. His response to the high priest question here, you can see there in verse 64, he says, you have said so. And so in effect, like what he's saying there in the phrase and how that's translated, what he means is a qualified yes, yes I am, but you mean something different by that than what I would mean by that. That's different than what I would say. And so then here he's going to explain what he means by what he would say in using that term for himself that's different than what the high priest means when he uses that term. And he what he does is he uses language from Psalm 110, verse 1, and from Daniel 7, verse 13. He says this. He says, you have said so, but I tell you, from now on you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And so Jesus uses another term for the Messiah here to define who he would say that he is when he uses the term Son of Man for himself, when he's understanding that he is the Messiah king. What he means is that he's more than just a human king who will rule over one little kingdom here on earth. He means that he's the promised Messiah king who's going to sit at God's right hand and rule over the eternal, universal kingdom that's promised to the Son of Man in Daniel chapter 7. And like, don't miss what he's saying here. He's saying that's not just something that's going to happen sometime in the future, at some point in the future. He's saying it's about to happen right now. He says, from now on, like, this is huge. We'll come back to this later. But for right now, the high priest, like, gets what Jesus is saying here. He gets the claim that Jesus is making. And in one sense, in the context of what's happening here, it plays right into the high priest's hands. Because he hears that Jesus is claiming things that God alone can claim. Which, if anyone else were to claim those things, it would be blasphemy. And that's what the high priest says here, which according to Leviticus 24 deserves the death sentence. And so the high priest then turns to the rest of the Sanhedrin and asks for their judgment, and they hand down their verdict there in verse 66 that Jesus deserves death. Like, their verdict is that Jesus is guilty. And so here's the thing. All through this section, we're given details, though, that turn their whole verdict on its head. First, there's a number of details that Matthew's audience, his original audience, would have picked up on that you need to be familiar with how a trial like this was supposed to go to pick up on some of these details here. And so here's just a few of the Sanhedrin's own rules that they break here in Jesus' trial. Number one, trials were to be held during the daytime, not at night like we see here. Number two, trials were to take place in a specified courtroom, which the palace of the high priest, where they are here, is not one. Number three, trials were to begin by hearing the case for the defense, not with accusations. Number four, trials were not allowed to reach a conviction on the same day as the trial began, which meant that trials were not supposed to take place on the eve of a Sabbath or a festival like the Passover, like is happening here. And so for anyone familiar with how trials like this were supposed to be conducted, the details that Matthew includes along the way are like one red flag after another, that the Jewish religious leaders are breaking rule after rule after rule in Jesus' trial. Not only that, but look back again at verse 59. We're told right at the beginning of Jesus' trial that the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus that they might put him to death. And so not only is the whole trial unfair from the beginning because the Sanhedrin has already made up their mind what the outcome is going to be before the trial even starts, like don't miss that even in looking for witnesses against Jesus, they're looking for false testimony against him. Like, they know that their witnesses are going to need to be able to stand up in court when they go to the Romans. So they know they have to at least find two witnesses whose stories line up with each other. But they're not looking for legitimate witnesses. It says they're looking for false witnesses, which not bearing false witness is one of the Ten Commandments. And on top of that, Deuteronomy chapter 19, verses 18 and 19 say this. It says, "The judges shall inquire diligently. And if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother. So you shall purge the evil from your midst." Which not only did the Sanhedrin not do this in looking for these false witnesses, they're the ones seeking out the false witness in the first place, so those verses should be applied to them as well. Not only that, but look at what the high priest does then in response to Jesus' statement in verse 64. In verse 65, it says that the high priest tore his robes, which on one sense sounds like a really pious thing to do in response to blasphemy. Like he's heartbroken that he would hear such a thing. The only problem is Leviticus 21 verse 10 says this, "The priest who is chief among his brothers, on whose head is the anointing oil, or the anointing oil is poured, and who's been consecrated to wear the garments, shall not let the hair of his head hang loose, nor tear his clothes." So in trying to seem righteous, he does something he's not supposed to do. So, like, do you see what's going on here? Like, all through Jesus' trial before the Jewish religious leaders, they're trying to prove that Jesus is guilty and deserving of death. But the way they go about it proves the exact opposite. Specifically, that they're guilty, even to an extent that the death penalty should come down on them. So that's the first part of the bad news here in Jesus' trial, that the Jewish religious leaders are guilty. That's just the beginning. Next, we see that Peter is guilty as well. Again, we don't have time to go through this line by line, but this is a familiar part of the story. And so we saw this last week when Jesus was initially arrested. All the disciples left him and fled. But at the beginning of our passage this week in verse 58, if you look back there real quick, you'll notice that Peter apparently found a way to sneak back around and hang on the fringe of the crowd to get into the high priest's courtyard and see what would happen to Jesus. And so we get that little preview in verse 58, and then here in verse 69, then we pick back up with that. We shift focus from Jesus during his trial before the Sanhedrin, and we get to see what's going on with Peter then in the courtyard as Jesus' trial is going on. And so it turns out that what's happening to Peter is that he's going through a trial of his own, right? He gets recognized by some people in the crowd, first in verse 69 by a servant girl, and then another servant girl, it says in verse 71, and then in verse 73 by some bystanders that are there as well. And so the irony in this here is that while Jesus is standing before the most threatening accusers a Jew could face, standing in front of the high priest and the Sanhedrin and facing their accusations, Peter is standing in the courtyard before the least threatening accusers that somebody could think of in that context. Like in that context, a servant girl would have had no authority whatsoever and that should have made Peter afraid. And so, like, to be fair, at the same time, if Peter did get recognized as one of Jesus' disciples and Jesus did get sentenced to death, like, it could turn into a dangerous situation for Peter. And so we're somewhat sympathetic with the fear that he feels, but at the same time, like, we're meant to see the contrast in who Jesus is standing before and who Peter is standing before. And so, like, we know how this story plays out then. When people in the crowd think they recognize Peter as one of Jesus' followers and question him, Peter denies Jesus three times, right? The first time is in verse 70, and he just denies it there and says, "I don't know what you mean," which, that's not good. That's a lie. He does know what they mean, and he is who the servant girl thinks that he is. But then the second time, he digs the hole deeper. Look at verse 72 here. It says he denies being with Jesus with an oath, it says, which we saw earlier in Matthew, back in chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, that Jesus taught that his followers shouldn't use oaths at all, that our word should be trustworthy on its own, that anything more than yes or no, Jesus said, comes from evil. And so Peter's not only lying, he's adding oaths to the lie to try to cover up the lie and digging the hole even deeper in his second denial. But he doesn't stop there. The third time, if you look at verse 74, Matthew says that Peter began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, "I do not know the man." And so the words "invoke a curse" there mean to condemn something to destruction. And so the question is, what is Peter condemning to destruction here? And so the ESV, the version that we're reading from here, says that Peter is invoking this curse on himself, as if he's putting himself under a curse if he's lying. But the "on himself" there in the ESV isn't actually in the original. Like, it doesn't specifically say who Peter is invoking this curse on. And so it could be on himself. That's one possibility. It could also be on the bystanders who are questioning him, that he's calling down a curse on them. It could also be on Jesus, which would be even more serious and shocking. And in some senses, the way this is worded, and I don't know, I'm maybe drawn to thinking that could very well be what Peter was doing here, is cursing Jesus to distance himself from Jesus. And so no matter what, though, whichever one of those is actually what he was doing, the point is that while Jesus is on trial before the Sanhedrin, Peter is basically right outside, not standing up for Jesus like he insisted that he would do just a few verses ago, but instead denying him three times, and with increasing severity and with increasing even sin in the way that he does it. And so the question is Peter innocent or guilty? Based on what we see here, what he does here, we have to say he's guilty, right? And he knows it. Like, as soon as he denies Jesus the third time, a rooster crows, just like Jesus had told him would happen, and he realizes what he's done, and it says he goes out and he weeps bitterly. Like, he knows that he's guilty. But there's even more bad news than this. Next, Judas is guilty as well. That's what we see in the first part of chapter 27. Look at chapter 27, verse 3. It says, "Then when Judas, his betrayer, saw that Jesus was condemned, he changed his mind and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, 'I have sinned by betraying innocent blood.' They said, 'What is that to us? See to it yourself.' And throwing down the pieces of silver into the temple, he departed, and he went and hanged himself." So again, there's so much here I wish we had time to get into. But in the context of what we're trying to see here in this passage this morning, like, in one sense, we already know that Judas is guilty, right? We're told here in verse 3 that he's Jesus' betrayer, and we've already seen that over the last couple of weeks. He betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. He came and kissed him and handed him over to be arrested. And so we already know that he's guilty because we've seen what he's done. But Judas here doesn't leave it up to us to figure out that he's guilty. Like, he confesses it himself. Like, he feels guilty for what he's done, and so he brings back the money to the chief priests and the elders and confesses to them that he's guilty of betraying innocent blood. But what happens is they won't take the money back, basically tell Judas that's his problem. And so Judas throws the money into the temple and leaves and hangs himself. And so the point here in this is not that Judas was actually repentant. And we see that in this contrast between Peter and Judas. Like, in putting Peter and Judas back to back here, Matthew means for us to compare their grief over their sin. Later on, Peter's grief leads him back to Jesus, and he's eventually restored by Jesus. But Judas' grief leads him to try to atone for his own sin, first by trying to return the money, and then ultimately by taking his own life. And so the point in all this is, again, the question is Judas innocent or guilty? And from what we see here, the answer again is he's guilty. And the bad news just keeps coming. Next, we see that Pilate is guilty. And so jumping down to chapter 27, verse 11, Jesus stands trial now before Pilate, the Roman governor, who's the one who actually has the authority now to carry out the death sentence that the Jewish religious leaders have already pronounced. And so Pilate asked Jesus there in verse 7, here's the question that Pilate asked for him as as Jesus is on trial before Pilate. He says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Which apparently, at least one of the charges that the Sanhedrin brought to Pilate is this. He mentions in verse 3 how many things they testify against you. So it seems to be that the Sanhedrin comes with a whole laundry list of accusations against Jesus and charges against Jesus. But the main one that Pilate highlights here is this one. And so in a lot of ways, this is the same question that the high priest asked Jesus back in chapter 26. So to be the Messiah is to be, like we've been talking about all through, the promised Messiah king from the line of David, meaning the king of the Jews. And so it makes sense then that from Pilate's Roman perspective, the potential crime here is whether Jesus is setting himself up as the king of the Jews in opposition to Rome's authority over the Jews. And so this is the logical question then for Pilate to ask Jesus. But notice then that Jesus' response to Pilate in verse 11 here is basically the exact same response as his response to the high priest back in chapter 26. He says, "You have said so." Again, a qualified yes, like, "Yes, I am, but you mean something different by that than what I would mean by that." Only here, Jesus doesn't say anything more than that, which amazes Pilate. Like, Pilate's stunned that's all he has to say. And what's interesting is it really seems like from that point, Pilate is pretty convinced that Jesus is innocent. And he tries to come up with a way to let Jesus go. But this isn't the only evidence that Pilate has that Jesus is innocent. Like, we're also told in verse 18 here, in chapter 27, verse 18, that Pilate knew that the Jewish religious leaders delivered Jesus up out of envy. Meaning he knew that Jesus was a personal threat to them. And Pilate knew, he was aware that that was the only reason that they brought Jesus to him and why they wanted him dead. And so in Pilate's mind, like, that's evidence that Jesus is actually innocent as well, along with kind of picking up from his conversation with Jesus, this guy's not a threat, he's not guilty. But then on top of that, not only is just his own conversation with Jesus and his knowledge of the Sanhedrin's ulterior motives feeding into his sense that Jesus is probably innocent. On top of that, look at verse 19. Verse 19 says, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, so while Pilate is in his courtroom interview with Jesus, Pilate's wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." So not only does Pilate seem to know that Jesus is innocent, and he knows the Jewish religious leaders have these ulterior motives in seeking Jesus' death, but then it seems like God, on top of that, somehow speaks to Pilate's wife in a dream to have her warn him to have nothing to do with this case against Jesus. So the point is, Pilate has no excuse for condemning Jesus to death. Like, he has the authority, number one, and he has all the evidence that he needs to just say he's not guilty, case dismissed. But that's not what he does. He does try to find a politically acceptable way to let Jesus go without directly rejecting the Jewish religious leaders. That's what we see in verses 15 to 23. We'll come back to that more here in just a minute. But his plan backfires in a big way, to the point that verse 24 says the people are starting to riot. And so Pilate caves in. He tries to distance himself from what he's doing. Like, verse 24 says, he symbolically washes his hands of the blood of Jesus. But in a lot of ways, that just shows even more clearly that he knew what he was doing was wrong. And then he hands Jesus over to be scourged and to be crucified. And so again, at one level, Jesus is the one on trial before Pilate. And Pilate's verdict is that he legally condemns Jesus to death. But in the way the story unfolds, it's Pilate who's on trial here as well. And it's clear that he knows the right thing to do, and yet he doesn't do it. And so no matter how much he might wish he could wash his hands of the guilt of what he does here, he can't. And so the question is Pilate innocent or guilty? And the verdict against Pilate, from what we have here, is that Pilate as well is guilty. But we're not done here in this section. There's still a couple of more in this section who are guilty as well. We'll see next then that Barabbas is guilty. Verses 15 to 23 that we kind of referenced a second ago but kind of skipped over, we're told in verses 15 to 23 that Pilate, what he tries to do to get out of this whole thing with Jesus is to offer to release Jesus based on a custom of releasing a Jewish prisoner for Passover. And Pilate thinks he can get the people to pick Jesus to be released by giving them only one other option. And the option that he gives them is a man named Barabbas, who, if you look there at verse 16, we're told that Barabbas is a notorious prisoner. And so the point is that Barabbas is not an innocent man who is falsely accused. Like, he's a real criminal, and everybody knew it. And so, in a sense, Barabbas is guilty in a slightly different way than the others that we've seen so far. But if the question is whether Barabbas is innocent or guilty, the answer is Barabbas is guilty and everybody knows it. Not only that, the last part of the bad news of Jesus' trial, you can see this, is that all the people are guilty as well. All the people are guilty. And so the crowd first comes into play in this same section, verse 15, where Pilate offers them the choice between Jesus and Barabbas. And the Jewish leaders have a hand in this again, because we're told in verse 20 that the chief priests, the elders, persuade the crowd to ask for Barabbas instead of Jesus. And so, like, they're being manipulated here, but the people don't stand up to the leaders. They go along with what the leaders convince them to do. And they even get more and more riled up to the point that when Pilate asks what he should do with Jesus, it's the crowds that call for Jesus to be crucified. Even when Pilate asks them why in verse 23, like, what evil has he done? And they don't respond. They just keep calling for him to be crucified. And so it's their action in that sense that leads to Pilate washing his hands of Jesus' blood in verse 24, which then leads to one of the most chilling verses in the entire account, verse 25. It says, and all the people answered, his blood be on us and on our children. So all the people, it says, every last one, take responsibility for Jesus' blood. Like, they're all willing to take credit for Jesus' death. And so one more time, then the question is, are the people innocent or guilty? And the answer is, they're guilty. All of them. And so this final point then in this long list of bad news drives the main point home. All along the way, everyone involved in Jesus' trial has turned against him and been involved in Jesus being condemned to die. But the point is that in so doing, every single person has proven themselves guilty. They're each guilty of sin in different ways that we've seen all along the way. And they're ultimately guilty for rejecting Jesus. And so I know we just flew through a whole lot, but don't miss the point in all this. Like, over the years since Matthew wrote these verses, people have tried to use these verses to determine and figure out who's ultimately to blame in Jesus' conviction and death. Like, is it the Jewish religious leaders? Is it the Romans? Is it the Gentiles? Is it Judas? Is it the Jewish crowd? But Matthew's point isn't that any one of these people or groups of people is to blame. It's that we all are. It's that we're all sinners. And that we're all guilty of rejecting Jesus and condemning him to death. Like, not only the people there and then, but us here and now as well. Like, we might not have been alive then to be directly involved, but the fact that every single person who was turned against Jesus and every single one of them was guilty leaves us no room to think that if we'd been there, that we would have been the exception. Like, we all suffer from the same root heart issue that caused everyone then to turn against Jesus and to reject him and to condemn him to death. And it's critical that we don't rush past this if we're going to be able to understand the good news that we'll get to in just a minute. In his book, The Cross of Christ, John Stott has this great quote. He says, before we can begin to see the cross as something done for us, we have to see it as something done by us. Like, that's the point here. And, hymn writer Horatius Bonar makes this point even more personal in an old hymn he wrote that's called "I See the Crowd in Pilate's Hall." Like he gives us words for what we should feel at this point. He says this. He says, "I see the crowd in Pilate's Hall. I mark their wrathful mien, their shouts of crucify appall with blasphemy between. And of that shouting multitude, I feel that I am one. And in that din of voices rude, I recognize my own. I see the scourges tear his back. I see the piercing crown. And of the crowd who smite and mock, I feel that I am one. Around yon cross the throng I see, mocking the sufferer's groan. Yet still my voice it seems to be as if I mocked alone. 'Twas I that shed the sacred blood. I nailed him to the tree. I crucified the Christ of God. I joined the mockery." Like, that's what we all need to see and feel at this point in Matthew's account of Jesus' trial. Like, the point isn't to look down on everyone here in this passage for their guilt. It's to recognize that we're right there with them, and we would have been right there with them if we had been there that day. And so if the question in all of this is who's guilty, the answer is we all are. The answer each one of us ought to give is I am. Like, that's the bad news in Matthew's account of Jesus' trial. Like, apart from Jesus, everyone, including us, is guilty and deserving of God's just wrath. But the whole point of starting there and of spending so much time there is so that we can get to then the good news in Matthew's account of Jesus' trial. And so that when we hear it, it'll be the best news that you can even imagine hearing this morning. And so there's two parts to the good news in Jesus' trial. And we're going to try to fly through this as quickly as we can. But the first part is this. It's that Jesus alone is innocent and not deserving of God's wrath. And so again, the whole point of this passage is that Jesus is on trial, and the ultimate question throughout is Jesus innocent or guilty? We've already seen what the official verdict of the court is, both the Jewish court and the Roman court. And so, like, the Jewish court declared Jesus guilty and deserving of death. The Roman court was more complicated, but in the end, they sentenced Jesus to scourging and crucifixion, so they say he's guilty and he's deserving of death. But that's not the verdict that the passage as a whole leads us to about Jesus. Instead, as the Jewish court and the Roman court come to their verdicts, Matthew is showing us the truth about Jesus all along, and it's this. First, it's that Jesus is who he claimed to be. We see this in both of the courtroom scenes. Like, in both cases, Jesus is presented with a question about his identity. Specifically, the high priest asked Jesus if he's the Christ, the Son of God, in chapter 26, verse 63. And then Pilate asked him if he's the King of the Jews in chapter 27, verse 11. And it, like we saw, in both cases, Jesus has the same response. He is. The high priest and Pilate had faulty understandings of what that means, but the question is, if the question is Jesus the Messiah? Is he the promised king from the line of David? The answer is yes. That's exactly who Jesus is. Like, that's who Matthew's been proving Jesus to be throughout this entire book up to this point. And so by the time Jesus is faced with these questions here, we know that Jesus is right when he answers these questions the way that he does. So even though the high priest thinks that Jesus claiming to be the Messiah is blasphemy, and even though Pilate doesn't take Jesus' claim to be king seriously enough to condemn him for it, we know that their verdict is actually wrong, and Jesus is telling the truth. Like, he is who he claimed to be. And so Matthew intends for us to see that in Jesus' responses to his courtroom questioning, that he's telling the truth and that he is who he claims that he is. And so I mentioned this earlier, there's all kinds of irony in the fact that Jesus is who he claimed to be in the context of his trial here. First, it's specifically these claims that he is the Messiah and that he's the King of the Jews that Jesus is ultimately judged as guilty and condemned to death for. So the Sanhedrin and Pilate find Jesus guilty and sentence him to death for his claims to be who he really is. That's the first irony, but not only that, but going back to Jesus' claim in chapter 26, verse 64 that we looked at earlier, that from now on you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power. What Jesus is saying there is that this identity isn't just something that will take effect sometime in the future. He's saying that the Sanhedrin is going to see Jesus' enthronement from now on, meaning like it's happening right then. And so what we're going to see in the next couple of Sundays is that Jesus' crucifixion is actually his enthronement ceremony. And so the irony is that the high priest and the Sanhedrin rule that Jesus is guilty and deserving of death for claiming to be the Messiah, but it's through their verdict that he actually takes his throne to be the Messiah king that they kill him for claiming to be. So the point is, Jesus is innocent because he's who he claims to be, and it's their verdict that he's guilty that actually proves that he's innocent. Which leads then to the second way that Matthew shows that Jesus is the one innocent one in this trial. And I should have come up with a better way to say this. Jesus is innocent because he's innocent. What I mean to say here is that Jesus, or that Matthew specifically tells us that Jesus is innocent. Like, he uses that word here in this section in Matthew 27, 1 through 10 to specifically tell us that Jesus is innocent. And so he wants to make sure that we know that that's the verdict. And he does so, he tells us that Jesus is innocent on the lips of one of the last people that we would expect to hear it from in this passage. Again, saw this already when we were looking at Judas. Chapter 27, verse 4, when Judas sees that Jesus is condemned by the Sanhedrin, he comes to the chief priests and the elders and tells them that he's sinned by betraying innocent blood. And so, in case we miss the point that Matthew's making in his account of Jesus' trial, and in case we're tempted to say, well, Judas was one of his disciples. Maybe he knew things about Jesus that not many other people knew. So maybe he knew that Jesus was guilty in some way, and that's why he betrayed him. Instead, Judas himself specifically says that Jesus was innocent. So, like, in a lot of ways, if somebody else had directly said this, we might have reason to question whether their testimony was trustworthy. But for the person who betrayed him to ultimately confess that he's innocent is kind of hard to ignore. So the thing is, Judas might be the one that says it specifically, but all throughout this passage, Jesus has proven to be innocent as well. Like, the Sanhedrin couldn't even find two consistent false witnesses to bring charges against Jesus, much less a true one. The only charge they could find at all was something that he said that was misunderstood, and then his claim to be who he actually was. Even in the end, Pilate asked the crowd, "What evil has he done?" And no one can give him an answer because there isn't one. So all the way through, the question with each person we've talked about is, are they innocent or guilty? And so for Jesus, he's the main one this passage is focused on. If we're asking that question about him, Jesus is the only one that the answer is he's innocent. The thing is, it's really important that Jesus is innocent. It's really, really important for him to be innocent. We'll talk more about why in just a minute, but it's also important that Jesus is more than just innocent. That being innocent just means he's not guilty. It means he doesn't have a debt to pay. But it's also important that we see here in Jesus' trial next that Jesus is righteous. We see this specifically when Jesus is before Pilate, and Pilate's wife sends word to him in chapter 27, verse 19, to have nothing to do with that righteous man. So the point here is that Jesus isn't just innocent. It's only that he's not guilty. It's that he's positively righteous. Like, not only has he not done anything to be judged guilty or condemned to die, all throughout his entire life, he's only done what's right. Where everyone else since Adam and Eve have been born sinners who then actually sin, Jesus is the one person who's ever been born righteous and then who lived a perfectly righteous life. Like, that's the verdict that he should have received at his trial. Not only not guilty, but righteous. Like, God gave Pilate's wife a dream so that his testimony about Jesus would be clear in Jesus' trial. So even though the official verdict against Jesus is that he's guilty, that he deserves to die, and he's delivered up to be scourged and crucified, Matthew makes it clear all along the way that Jesus is actually innocent. And even more than that, that he's righteous. So the bad news is that everyone but Jesus is guilty. The good news is that Jesus alone is innocent. He is who he claimed to be. He's innocent. He's righteous. And so the question is, how in the world is that good news? How is it good news that the one innocent man in the whole trial, ultimately the one innocent man who's ever lived, how is it good news that he's found to be guilty by guilty people? Here's how. Oh, and if you've never heard this before, do I have some good news for you? is that Jesus was condemned to death as our substitute to save his people from their sins. Like, that's the gospel. Going all the way back to Matthew chapter 1, verse 21, Jesus came to be the promised Messiah King from the line of David who would save his people from their sins. And this is how he does it, by living an innocent, righteous life, by being proven to be innocent and righteous and who he claimed to be in his trial, yet by being condemned to die as if he was guilty, so that he could take the place of all the guilty people who condemned him to die, so that he could be our substitute, so that our sin and our death that we deserve to die for our sin could be laid on him, so that his righteousness and the life that belongs to him could ultimately be shared with us. Like, it's no accident that all of this is taking place during the celebration of Passover, when God delivered his people from slavery in Egypt by sending an angel to kill the firstborn son in every family. But then he made a way for the life of the firstborn son to be spared through a substitute, right? Each family could take a lamb, a perfect lamb with no blemishes or spots, and that lamb could be killed, and its blood could be spread on the doorposts of the house. And so when the angel saw the blood of the spotless lamb, it would pass over that house and spare the life of that son. And so with that picture in mind, there's a couple of details then here in Jesus' trial that show us his, the whole point in Jesus' trial and in Jesus' death is that he's our substitute. And we're going to just touch on these super fast. First, we see Jesus' life exchanged for Barabbas' life. Again, Barabbas was the notorious prisoner. He was guilty and everybody knew it. Pilate offered the crowd a choice between Barabbas and Jesus, and the crowd chose Barabbas. In one sense, it's shocking that the crowd would choose the guilty one over the innocent one. But don't miss what's happening here from Barabbas' perspective. Jesus just took his place. He's now a free man. The innocent one took the place of the guilty one so that the guilty one could go free. Like, Jesus was Barabbas' substitute. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Barabbas' name means son of the Father. Again, with Passover in mind, Jesus is condemned to die so that this son could live. Like, it's a picture of the gospel in Jesus' trial. He takes Barabbas' place as a preview of how he's about to take our place and become our substitute. But that's not the only detail in Jesus' trial that points to Jesus as our substitute. We see it also in the people's statement, his blood be on us and on our children. I mentioned earlier how, in one sense, it's the most chilling statement in this entire passage. Again, the point is the crowd is knowingly taking full responsibility for Jesus' death. But again, with Passover in mind, there's a significance and another meaning to this that the people surely don't understand in what they're saying here. In the Passover, Israel and their firstborn sons, their children, were spared by being covered by the blood of the spotless lamb. When the lamb's blood was on their doorpost, the lives of them and their children could be spared. So in one sense, Jesus' blood being on us and our children is our condemnation. Well, that's the part we talked about before. We rejected our king and put him to death. His blood is on us. We are guilty. His blood on us is our condemnation. But in another sense, in a Passover sense, Jesus' blood being on us and our children is our salvation. It's our only hope for our guilt to be dealt with and washed clean. Our only hope for our sin to be passed over and our lives to be spared is if we're covered by Jesus' blood as our Passover lamb, as our substitute, his death in our place, his blood covering our sin. Listen to what the prophet Isaiah says about the Messiah in light of everything we've seen in Jesus' trial. Isaiah 53, verse 7, it says, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. And back in verses 4 and 5, it says, surely he has borne our grief and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. Like, that's the gospel. That's the point of Jesus' trial. The innocent, spotless lamb declared guilty by the guilty ones and sentenced to death so that his blood can become the means of forgiveness and salvation for the very ones who put him to death. Like, that's really good news. Because apart from Jesus, every one of us is in the bad news category. We're all guilty and deserving of God's just wrath. But God made a way to pass over your guilt and over your sin. He made a way to rescue you from the wrath and from the death that you deserve. He sent his son to be your substitute, to take your place, to die in your place, to be pierced for your transgressions, to be crushed for your iniquities, so that by his wounds you could be healed, so that if his blood is on you, you can be spared. Oh, if you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, oh, hear the good news for you in this passage this morning. Jesus' blood is on you right now in a way that condemns you, but it can be on you in a way that saves you. What the Bible says you need to do for that to be true of you is to repent, to confess that you are guilty and that you deserve God's wrath, but then to look to Jesus as your substitute, as your Passover lamb. Put all your hope in his death in your place. You can do that right where you are. Just cry out to God and ask him to forgive you and cover your guilt with Jesus' innocent, righteous blood. If that's you, please don't leave this morning without talking to someone about what to do next. Like, come find me when we're done, or ask someone around you. We'd love to talk to you about what it means to be a Christian. For those of us who are here this morning who are Christians, I pray that this reminder in the gospel of Jesus, of the gospel in Jesus' trial, would be what our hearts need this morning. That we would be humbled by the reminder of who we were apart from Jesus, our guilt and the wrath that we deserved, but that we would be even more in awe of what Jesus has done for us in taking our place so that we can share in his righteousness, and that these weeks leading up to Easter, we would rejoice and celebrate what Jesus has done for us and who we now are in him. Would you pray with me? Father, thank you for this good news that we see even in spite of the bad news in Jesus' trial. Father, humble us with our guilt apart from Jesus, that apart from him, every one of us here would stand deserving death, would stand guilty before you, not only for our actual sin that we've committed, but for rejecting him as our king. That's what we deserve. That's how we stand before you apart from him. But because of him, because he lived the perfect, innocent life in our place, and then he went to this trial and was condemned as guilty in our place, he could be our substitute. And his blood can go from being on us in a sense that condemns us to being on us in a sense that saves us. So, Father, I pray that you would cause us to rejoice, cause people even in this room now to repent and put their trust in Jesus as their substitute. Remind us of who we are in him, Father, and all that that means for us this week and in the weeks ahead as we prepare our hearts for Easter. Thank you, Father, for this good news. Pray that you would apply it to us in the ways that we need this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.